Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Thursday, April 6, 2023. Tennessee House of Representatives passes a school safety bill after last week's mass shooting at a school in Nashville. The Republican majority in the Tennessee House also voting to expel three Democratic members who were accused of disrupting the House proceedings last week by leading protests on the House floor calling for stricter gun control provisions to be included in that school safety bill. White House releases its review of the chaotic U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan in 2021, blaming, quote, conditions created by his predecessor for limiting the available options to President Biden. A bipartisan congressional delegation lands in Taiwan one day after another bipartisan group of House members met with the president of Taiwan in California, despite China's threatening opposition. Veterans Affairs Secretary Dennis McDonough giving a status report on the PACT Act. That's the law signed last year that expands VA health care and benefits for veterans exposed to toxic substances, such as through burn pits. The new IRS Commissioner Danny Werfel talking about how the new $80 billion in agency funding through the Inflation Reduction Act will be spent. And the White House announces plans for the annual Easter egg roll. And we begin in Nashville, Tennessee, where hundreds of people protesting at the state capitol building, both inside and out.
No more science! No more science! No more science!
And they are protesting not only the passage today of a school safety bill by the Tennessee House that did not include strict gun control measures, but also votes to expel three Democratic state representatives who had taken part in a protest on the House floor last week in support of gun control. They've become known as the Tennessee Three: Justin Jones, Gloria Johnson, and Justin Pearson. The Nashville Tennessean newspaper reports that House Bill 322, the first bill taken up by the chamber, passed by a vote of 95-4 after a lengthy debate. It includes several policies backed by Governor Bill Lee and would require every school to have a school resource officer, allow private schools to partner with local police for school security efforts, and require Tennessee Department of Homeland Security agents to be placed in each county to evaluate and support school safety plans in both public and private schools. Before the vote, State Representative Justin Johnson spoke on the floor. You'll hear a response from Republican State Representative Mark White.
The majority leader just stated that we would do whatever we have to make students feel safe. In the past week, we've seen thousands of students here at the state capitol asking us to do one thing, and that is to ban assault weapons. Nowhere in this bill do I hear the word, or do I see the word, guns, AR-15s, assault weapons, the things that actually are traumatizing and terrorizing these young people. And so my question to the sponsor is that this bill seems to be a Band-Aid. It seems to be a white flag of surrender, when what we need to make our young people safe is a deep surgery of our system that places firearms above the lives of our children. If I may, Mr. Speaker, I want to read from Jeremiah 6:14 that says...
Representative Jones, that's outside the caption. You need to stay on the caption of the bill. I'm sorry, but you have to stay within the discussion on the bill that is outside. So if you would like to address questions or talk about school safety, that is welcome. Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. They offer superficial treatments for my people's mortal wound. They give assurances of peace when there is
Jones,
no peace.
Once again, that is not on the topic of the bill. Even your colleagues are nodding yes. I'm asking you again, please stay on the topic of the bill. If you have questions or statements based on that topic of the bill, then please continue. You're recognized, Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, the point I'm trying to make is that this bill is not about school safety. It will not make our students safer. Representative Lambert told the media that we must fortify our schools, even if it means putting tanks outside our schools. That is disturbing. I don't think any of us want to live in a world like that, where we make our schools militarized zones simply because we refuse to address the real issue, which is easy access to military-grade weapons, which is easy access to weapons of war on our streets. And so, again, I'm deeply troubled that we are making this political statement today by trying to act like we're doing something that is not going to do anything to prevent what occurred. More police officers in schools Yesterday they passed a bill to arm teachers. This is not going to make our students safe. And I think that we owe it to these young people, the thousands here who we tried to speak for when we were silenced, the thousands who are gathered outside demanding that we take real action to address the crisis of easy access to military-grade weapons in this state. And so with that, I must say that I cannot support this bill, because this bill is a Band-Aid. It is a white flag of surrender, and it is not action that will make our students safe. And no student, I talked to thousands of students, and not one of them said, this is what we want. And I think that we as elected officials have a moral responsibility to listen to these young people who are on the front lines, who are terrified, who are here crying and pleading for their lives. And so my question is to the sponsor, would you be willing to add some provision or to have a conversation about banning assault weapons to move our state forward? That's what these young people are asking. Would you be willing to do that, Chairman White?
Representative Jones, Chairman White.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Reverend Jones, look at me. Look at the other 97. This is exactly what we're trying to do. I have been up here 14 years. You have been in this assembly for 2 months, 3 months. We as a legislative body are constantly looking for ideas. But when things break down where we cannot continue to create and discuss ideas, this is where we get to, and this is what has led to this day. I used to be a school principal. I would literally step in front of anything for the protection of those little ones in my school. You assume that because we do not have everything that you may want or anyone else may want this bill, that this is a bad bill. We are trying to put things together to a starting place. So I answer your question with this. Yes, we've been trying to communicate with you and others on this floor since January. And here we are today. We have a good bill, and if you would work with us, we could have even a better bill in the future. That is my response to you.
Mark White, Tennessee State Representative, Republican, and you heard from Justin Jones, Democratic Representative, on the floor of the General Assembly in Nashville, Tennessee, before passage of this school safety bill. Again, the vote was 95-4. Tennessee House then moving on to resolutions to expel three Democratic state representatives for encouraging the crowd of student-led protests to chant gun control slogans last week, disrupting the floor. Two of the three accused of using a bullhorn to do so. The resolutions of expulsion say that they knowingly and intentionally brought disorder and dishonor on the House representatives through their individual and collective actions by moving in unison to the well and shouting without recognition, and after being called out of order, proceeding to disrupt House proceedings for nearly an hour. Tennessee State Representative Johnny Garrett, Republican, supporting the expulsions.
Today, in the People's House, we had 29 bills on the calendar. 29 bills that were debated. Everyone had an opportunity to speak, but most importantly, we had 29 bills, some that were in that well that were Democrats, some in this well that were Republicans. Today, our republic worked. Today, the gallery was able to watch and stand, watch us do our work. It worked today. That's what's supposed to happen on this House floor when we debate legislation. We hear each other. We don't hear the hate. We don't hear the vitriol. It worked today. It can work for the future. 1 week ago, Mr. Speaker, it didn't work. 1 week ago, we had members take it upon themselves to rush the well and stop the people's business. People will say that when they speak or when they can't speak under the permanent House of Order here in the People's House, that somehow that suppresses their word. It didn't happen today. And what happened 1 week ago is that members that shut the order of this institution down, silenced 7 million people.
Tennessee State Representative Johnny Garrett, a Republican, today in Nashville on the floor of the General Assembly, debate to expel three Democratic members of the Tennessee House. Opposing the resolutions, Karen Camper, the Democratic caucus leader in the Tennessee House.
We're here today because voices have been silenced. We're here today because we have a system that says we value a process. Yet in that process, particularly in our committees, voices are continuously silenced. Then we get to the floor, and the same is true. We don't get to fully vet bills. People can't represent their constituents' voices, and it has happened time and time again. This is not democracy. Democracy says your voice will be heard. I served 21 years in the military, and I do it again to protect democracy. I've traveled to other countries in the name of democracy. Yet, on this floor, for what appeared to be 15 seconds of a rule violation, we're not protecting democracy. Representative Jones represents thousands of people in this state whose voice have been silenced time and time and time again. And we had just had this mass shooting and only wanted to elevate the voices of those people. That's what he wanted to do. And for a simple rule violation, we have elevated this to the highest level of admonishment. That's not democracy.
Tennessee State Representative Karen Camper, a Democrat, during today's debate in Nashville, referencing Justin Jones, one of the three state representatives, the Democrats who are being expelled, votes to expel. The other two are Gloria Johnson and Justin Pearson. And Justin Jones did go to the floor and referred to the resolution against him as a spectacle and a lynch mob assembled to not lynch me, but our democratic process. The Chattanooga Times Free Press writes that Article 2 of the Tennessee Constitution says members of the General Assembly can dissent from and protest against any act they think could be damaging to the public or an individual. However, Article 2 also says each chamber of the General Assembly may determine the rules of its proceedings, punish its members for disorderly behavior, and with the concurrence of two-thirds, expel a member. The debate getting national attention, the White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre bringing it up at her briefing in Washington.
As I was walking out here today, we saw news that Republican legislators in Tennessee were preparing to vote on the expulsion of three Democratic officials who stood in solidarity with children and families peacefully protesting for action on gun safety. The fact that this vote is happening is shocking, undemocratic, and without precedent. Across Tennessee and across America, our kids are paying the price for the actions of Republican lawmakers who continue to refuse to take action on stronger gun laws. The president will continue to call on Congress to take action to ban assault weapons and high-capacity magazines, require safe storage of firearms, eliminate gun manufacturers' immunity from liability, and require background checks for all gun sales. And state officials must do the same.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre at her briefing, expelling representative in Tennessee requires a two-thirds majority vote. From Associated Press, President Joe Biden's administration on Thursday laid the blame on his predecessor, President Donald Trump, for the deadly and chaotic 2021 withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan that brought some of the darkest moments of Biden's presidency. The White House publicly released a 12-page summary of the results of the so-called hot wash of U.S. policies around the ending of the nation's longest war, taking little responsibility for its own actions and asserting that President Biden was severely constrained by former President Trump's decisions. AP article continues, the administration said detailed reviews conducted by the State Department and the Pentagon, which were transmitted privately to Congress on Thursday, were highly classified and would not be released publicly. John Kirby, spokesperson for the National Security Council, bringing this up in his opening statement at today's briefing.
While it was always the president's intent to end that war, it is also undeniable that decisions made and the lack of planning done by the previous administration significantly limited options available to him. President Biden inherited a forced presence in Afghanistan of some 2,500 troops. That was the lowest since 2001. He inherited a special immigrant visa program that had been starved of resources. And he inherited a deal struck between the previous administration and the Taliban that called for the complete removal of all U.S. troops by May of 2021, or else the Taliban, which had stopped its attacks while the deal was in place, would go back to war against the United States. The president's transition team asked to see plans for that removal. They asked to see plans for a security transition to the Afghan government. And they asked to see plans to increase the processing of special immigrant visas. None were forthcoming. Transitions matter. That's the first lesson learned here. And the incoming administration wasn't afforded much of one. Thus, President Biden's choice was stark: either withdraw all our forces or resume fighting with the Taliban. He chose the former. But even in so doing, secured extra time to conduct that withdrawal, stretching it out to August. And that's the second point worth making. Despite having his options curtailed, President Biden led a deliberate, rigorous, and inclusive decision-making process that was responsive to facts on the ground.
John Kirby is Strategic Communications Coordinator for the White House National Security Council, briefing reporters in the White House briefing room. Senator Steve Daines, Republican from Montana, tweeting, "Once again, the Biden administration is refusing to take responsibility for its failures and is destined to repeat them. President Biden's weakness on the world stage cost 13 American lives and is putting our national security at risk. He must be held accountable." Reporters asked John Kirby at the White House briefing about the timing of the release of this report.
John, thank you for doing this, but I think I speak on behalf of my colleagues in this room, and we want the record to reflect that this was sent to us about 10 minutes before the briefing began, with little notice, and it's the very definition of a modern major holiday news dump. Releasing this at the beginning of the high holidays and after months of requests from Republicans and the broader public. So why today? And is this all we get? And is this a response to the studies that were done by the agencies? Or is this considered a summary?
There's a lot there. This is the result of months and months of work by individual agencies who were participating in the withdrawal to voluntarily review that withdrawal, which they did. They worked through that. These documents are classified. And we felt it was the responsible thing to do after those reviews were done to then run a process across the administration to take a look at those reviews ourselves, across the interagency, work our way through it, and then provide them to the relevant committees and leaders on the Hill, which we did today. We think that was the responsible thing to do. And what you're seeing today is the result and the culmination of an awful lot of work, Ed. No effort here to try to obfuscate or try to bury something. It's an effort to try to be as open, as transparent as we can be. And what you got in that document there is a pretty fair summary of our perspectives of the work over those many months and pulling and collating a lot of those lessons learned together. And we're trying to present certainly the key lessons learned, the ones that we're able to share more openly and more publicly with you. And I'll tell you this, you got questions after the briefing today, I'll stay here as long as you want. You got questions after the briefing today, you know how to get a hold of me. We'll answer whatever you have.
John Kirby, Strategic Communications Coordinator for the National Security Council, questioned by Ed O'Keefe, Senior White House and Political Correspondent for CBS News at today's White House briefing. The House and Senate not in session this week or next week for the holidays. They're back on April 17th. United Nations Security Council holding a meeting today about the Taliban government of Afghanistan's decision to ban Afghan women from working for the United Nations. Reuters reports the United Nations has told some 3,300 Afghan staff, of which about 400 are female, not to report to their offices until further notice for security reasons. Some 600 international staff in the country are not affected by the ban. United Kingdom's ambassador to the UN, Barbara Woodward, speaking with reporters outside the Security Council meeting at the UN in New York City.
The Security Council is going to meet this morning to talk about the latest mandate from the Taliban in Afghanistan, banning women from participating in UN humanitarian delivery. It's an appalling thing. Two out of three Afghans depend on humanitarian aid. And the UN could not and should not have to depend on being able to deliver aid effectively without women. And more importantly, I think it shows us again that the Taliban is placing medieval misogyny above humanitarian need in Afghanistan. So we'll look forward to those further discussions this morning.
What can we expect from the Security Council? There have been statements before. This is what the UN is calling an escalation, because we've seen what the Taliban has decided as it relates to girls going to school, to universities. There have been statements from this council that essentially have been ignored to date. So what can this council deliver on this in terms of impact on the ground?
No, I think you're right. I mean, the 18 months since the Taliban took Kabul, we have seen a sustained campaign to take women out of life in Afghanistan. You've mentioned the primary schools, universities, being able to walk in the parks, participating in NGO delivery, and these rather egregious examples of humanitarian aid, healthcare, for example, being delivered to men that to pass on to women. So the council will continue to try and get a clear picture of events, to work through the UNAMA and the SRSG as well. But we do need to keep the pressure on the Taliban to prevent them excluding half of Afghanistan's population from life, not just public life, but from life altogether.
Barbara Woodward is the United Kingdom's ambassador to the United Nations, speaking at the UN in New York City. That audio from the UN. Sputnik News reports the UN is one of the few bodies on the ground distributing assistance in Afghanistan. The UN has said its $4.6 billion humanitarian emergency plan for Afghanistan for 2023 has achieved less than 5% of financing needs. This is Washington Today. Now to Israel. This from AP. Violence resumed for a second straight night in Jerusalem on Wednesday when Palestinian worshippers barricaded themselves inside Al-Aqsa Mosque in the Old City's sensitive compound, and Israeli police used force to remove dozens of worshippers. The unrest was less intense than the previous night, but the situation remained combustible as Muslims marked the Ramadan holy month and Jews began the week-long Passover holiday. Palestinian militants in the Gaza Strip renewed their rocket fire at Israel, raising fears of a wider conflagration. Questions about this today in Washington at the State Department briefing to spokesperson Vedant Patel.
On Al-Aqsa storming by the Israeli police and Israeli troops over the past two nights, do you have any comment on that? I mean, it seems to have been unprovoked.
Look, Saeed, we are concerned by the scenes out of Jerusalem, and it is our viewpoint that it is absolutely vital that the sanctity of holy sites be preserved. We emphasize the importance of upholding the historic status quo at the holy sites in Jerusalem, and any unilateral action that jeopardizes the status quo to us is unacceptable, and we call for restraint, coordination, and calm during the holiday season.
Have you called the Israelis, has anyone called the Prime Minister's office or the Minister of
I don't have any specific calls to read outside,
but urge them not to do this again.
You know.
Obviously, I mean, you know, the writing is on the wall. They will keep doing this all throughout the month of Ramadan.
Saeed,
and that can only, as we have seen today, that will only provoke, you know, kind of violence.
Saeed, I don't have any specific calls or engagements to read out to you, but we are in constant and regular touch with our Israeli partners as well as the Palestinian Authority about these issues, and so we'll continue to raise them directly.
But, you know, it has been all along the position of Secretary of State and this administration that, you know, to calm down in Ramadan.
That, you know, continues.
But we have seen exactly the opposite. I mean, it seems that the Maybe the Israeli government, maybe the prime minister himself thinks that by exporting, you know his crisis into the Al-Aqsa, maybe that would help.
Said, from this very podium, you have seen myself, you've seen Ned Price and other administration officials emphasize the importance of upholding the historic status quo of these historic holy sites in Jerusalem. And we continue to say quite forcefully that any unilateral action that jeopardizes the status quo is unacceptable. And that continues to be our posture on this.
Vedant Patel is a spokesperson with the State Department being questioned by Saeed Arakat, the Washington Bureau Chief for the Jerusalem-based newspaper Al-Quds, at today's State Department briefing in Washington. More from the Associated Press. Longtime Mideast rivals Iran and Saudi Arabia took another significant step toward reconciliation Thursday, formally restoring diplomatic ties after a seven-year rift, affirming the need for regional stability and agreeing to pursue economic cooperation. The agreement was reached in Beijing during a meeting between the Iranian and Saudi foreign ministers, a month after China had brokered an initial reconciliation agreement between the two regional powerhouses. That from AP. A bipartisan U.S. congressional delegation arriving in Taiwan today, one day after U.S. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy met with Taiwan's president, and other House members were there as well, Republicans and Democrats, in California. NBC News writes, the flurry of visits comes amid dramatically worsening China-U.S. relations as Beijing increases pressure on Taiwan, declines to criticize Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and grows more assertive internationally. China had criticized the McCarthy Tsai meeting, that Tsai Ing-wen, the Taiwanese president, as a provocation and a violation of the One China principle under which Washington recognizes Beijing as the sole legitimate government of China, while maintaining unofficial relations with Taipei. Congressional delegation, or CODEL, to Taiwan was led by Congressman Michael McCaul, Republican from Texas, chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee, who spoke to a Fox News reporter at the airport.
It's a very important, critical time in this region of the world. We just came back from Japan, South Korea, meeting with potential allies of Taiwan as they face Chinese aggression, the Chinese Communist Party. So being here, I think, sends a signal to the Chinese Communist Party that the United States supports Taiwan and that we're going to harden Taiwan and we want them to think twice about invading Taiwan.
Obviously, China condemned the meeting in California earlier. Is there any concern that this will only make matters worse?
Well, we're not going to let this intimidation, get to us. We all receive sort of threatening texts. There's talk about a Chinese escort in the air, but that's just really intimidation, saber rattling. I think the meetings we're going to have here are going to be very important in terms of, the next leadership. Meet with President Tsai, talk about weapon systems that I sign off on going into Taiwan to harden Taiwan. And are they prepared? Do we have enough deterrence to stop, aggression coming from Communist China?
And then last question here, are you going to promise the Taiwanese that the U.S. will come to its aid militarily in case China tries to invade?
Well, that's ultimately under the Taiwan Assurance Act, Relations Act. That's something we can arm Taiwan, and we can give them assurances of self-defense. But ultimately, that's going to be made by the American people. But I certainly will be discussing the weapon sales that I've signed off on with President Tsai.
Congressman Michael McCaul, Republican from Texas, Foreign Affairs Committee Chair at the airport in Taiwan. Again, that audio from Fox News. Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen scheduled to meet with Congressman McCaul and the bipartisan delegation on Saturday. It's her third meeting in a little over a week with leaders. Speaking yesterday in California with House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, and when she was transiting from the Central American countries back to Taiwan, she also stopped in New York and met with the House Democratic leader, the minority leader, Hakeem Jeffries. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts and on the C-SPAN Now mobile app. A few more headlines. This from The Hill. Democrats are voicing outrage following a report that Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas accepted luxury trips for more than two decades from a Republican mega donor without disclosing them. Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Dick Durbin, Democrat from Illinois, said his committee will act following the report. His statement reads, "The highest court in the land shouldn't have the lowest ethical standards. Today's ProPublica report reveals that Justice Thomas has for years accepted luxury travel on private yachts and jets and a litany of other gifts that he failed to disclose. This behavior is simply inconsistent with the ethical standards American people expect of any public servant, let alone a justice of the Supreme Court." Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat from New York, in a tweet calling for Justice Thomas to be impeached. And this from CNN, House Judiciary Committee Chair Jim Jordan, Republican from Ohio, subpoenaed former New York County Special Assistant District Attorney Mark Pomerantz for his role investigating Donald Trump and his business empire, as House Republicans attempt to frame the recent indictment against the former president as politically motivated. An update today from Veterans Affairs Secretary Dennis McDonough on implementation of the PACT Act. That's the bill that expands VA health care and benefits for veterans exposed to burn pits, Agent Orange, radiation, and other toxic substances. It was signed into law about 7.5 months ago. Secretary McDonough is saying that just under 10% of all the veterans believed to be eligible have filed claims.
We think that there are roughly a little over 6.2 million veterans who we believe qualify for the PACT Act. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a lot of records issues in there and stuff, for example, so there's still a lot of Vietnam vets for whom we don't have great deployment records because of the fire at the National Personnel Records Center many years ago. So if that's what you're starting with, so let's take out those bad record numbers. So then we're at, like, let's call it 5.3 million veterans we think qualify. Mm-hmm. To date, we've had about 450,000 veterans file a claim under the PACT Act. So you can see 450,000 and see a big number, or you can see a small number. I choose to see a small number, mm-hmm. especially when we're working with a denominator of, north of 5 million. Veterans in our care can get what's called a toxic exposure screening, which is, in effect, a conversation with your primary care provider about what you've experienced in terms of exposure. And we've now given about 2.3 million toxic exposure screenings. I actually legit see that as a big number. Importantly, 40% of those veterans tell us about an exposure that we were not aware of, meaning these are veterans already in our care and we're learning something from them about what they're exposed to. And that allows us then to forward on that veteran to specialists or further review. So that gives you a sense of how it's going. The question then is, why is that 450,000 number? Why isn't it bigger? Mm. I think there's probably three reasons, and I think each of them points to the question you're asking. One is there's just a general lack of trust issue in VA. Mm-hmm. It's not everybody, and the trust numbers are getting better. And later this year, we're going to start for the first time applying the V-Signal, so that's our trust survey, to the compensation benefit portfolio. So that'll be an important new data set. So one, we have to get over the trust issue. Second, there are a lot of vets who are unaware
right. That
this is out here. And so that's just going to be us having to get out there more aggressively in fora like this, but also just in individual conversations with veterans, which I know we all have, just even walking on the street or on a plane. These are all conversations I've had just in the last week alone. The third issue is there are veterans who are aware of it, but think they don't qualify or think they shouldn't qualify. And those are two different things. One, there's a reservist woman deployed into combat zones on six different deployments. She just assumed that as a reservist, She didn't qualify. Incidentally, women veterans are more likely to be in category 2 or 3 than other veterans to think, hey, to be unaware or to think that they don't qualify. Then we have a whole group of veterans, warriors, who say somebody else needs it more than I do. So they choose not to file. Well, here's what I can tell you about that. The way we prosecute these claims now using automation means when you file your claim, Kelly Kennedy, your claim, we can use automation to understand that claim, but then also helps us tell a better story about veterans in your unit, veterans who are in the unit that relieved you, veterans who are in the unit that you relieved. So actually, your filing doesn't take from anybody. It actually helps us understand the bigger picture so we can actually then make benefit decisions for everybody. Our ability to make progress in categories 1, 2, and 3, increase trust, make sure people are aware, and then make sure people know that they personally are aware and that they're not taking something from somebody, depends on us getting out to veterans in trusted voices. And this question, I know you're talking a lot about trusted voices today. I've seen that. That is the most important thing.
Mm-hmm. Veterans Affairs Secretary Dennis McDonough, conversation at the War Horse Symposium at the University of Chicago today. War Horse is a nonprofit news organization that says it, quote, holds power to account, strengthens our democracy, and improves understanding of the true cost of military service. You can find the full event with Dennis McDonough at our website, cspan.org. IRS today releasing the strategic operating plan about how the $80 billion the IRS will be getting under last year's legislation, known as the Inflation Reduction Act, will be spent. Republicans in Congress who voted against the bill have criticized the extra money, saying it would be used to hire what some called an army of IRS agents to audit middle-class Americans, some of those members using the figure 87,000 new agents. The IRS Commissioner Danny Werfel saying at his ceremonial swearing-in on Wednesday, that's not true.
What will the plan mean for taxpayers? In the short and long term, here are just a few things the IRS will accomplish. An end to long wait times on the phone, regardless of the time of year. So calling the IRS will no longer frustrate taxpayers and tax professionals. More service locations and more IRS staff to provide in-person help that has been sorely missing for many years in so many parts of the nation. More digital tools to help people get the service and the information they need. For example, this will mean a more detailed version of refund tracking so people have a clearer view of when and where their refunds are in the processing pipeline. More digital scanning to speed processing of paper returns we receive. This will reduce errors and speed refunds for paper filers. And an expanded online account, so taxpayers and tax professionals have a clearer view of their tax information and easier ways to address issues with their tax return. For example, taxpayers will be able to respond to IRS issues instantly by electronic means, avoiding weeks of mailings and paper processing. For many, letters from the IRS in the mail could be a thing of the past. Add these all up, and the new IRS will make a very complex tax system much easier for people. It will be easier for them to file and understand their tax obligations. This will make it easier for people to claim the vital credits they are entitled to, something millions of people can overlook each year by, for example, missing out on the earned income tax credit and other vital credits. So not only will our work help provide bigger and faster refunds for many, but these changes will also help people get it right the first time, avoiding follow-up contacts from the IRS and reducing the need for potential audits. Now, what will the plan mean for our future efforts to ensure compliance with tax laws? We want people to avoid audits in the first place, but we understand that we must safeguard the nation's tax law and revenue needs. So we will hire and train specially skilled staff to give us much greater capacity to unpack the complex return filings of high-income taxpayers, large corporations, and complex partnerships. Let me note something about our civil side compliance employees. Despite what some might think or say, these public servants within the IRS are armed only with calculators and their skills to help us address complex issues. Their work will give people confidence that all taxpayers, regardless of means, are being treated fairly under the tax laws.
The IRS Commissioner Danny Werfel at his ceremonial swearing-in on Wednesday at the IRS building in Washington, D.C. That audio from the Treasury Department feed. Danny Werfel is the 50th permanent IRS commissioner in the agency's history. Federal income tax return filing deadline, by the way, is in 12 days, April 18th. On Wall Street today, the Dow up 2, NASDAQ up 91, S&P up 14. CNN reports that President Joe Biden on Thursday vetoed a resolution that would have rescinded his administration's hallmark water rule, with proponents of the rollback arguing that the regulation places a burden on the agriculture community by being too restrictive in defining what is a navigable waterway. This is the second veto of the Biden presidency. And from the New York Times, the Supreme Court ruled on Thursday that a transgender girl may compete on the girls' cross-country and track teams at her middle school in West Virginia while her appeal moved forward, signaling that a majority of the justices are not ready to enter another battleground in the culture wars. Easter holiday is this Sunday, and on Monday, the White House will be hosting the annual Easter egg roll, about 30,000 children and adults taking part on the White House lawn. Theme this year is education. More from the White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre.
On Monday, the President and a First Lady will host the 2023 White House Easter Egg Roll, a tradition dating back to 1878. A teacher for more than 30 years, First Lady Jill Biden is continuing her theme of education for the event, transforming the South Lawn and the Ellipse into a school community full of fun educational activities for children of all ages to enjoy. In addition, the time-honored traditions of rolling and hunting eggs this year's White House Easter Egg Education Roll will also feature a schoolhouse activity area, reading nook, talent show, field trip to the farm, picture day, a physical education zone, a snack time tent, and more.
The White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre during her briefing. As an additional promotion, NASA sending a souvenir wooden White House Easter egg to the International Space Station for the astronauts to help teach students about gravity. And NASA posting this video.
Hi, I'm NASA astronaut Woody Hoberg, currently orbiting about 260 miles above the Earth aboard the International Space Station. We are looking forward to seeing you at the White House Easter Eggucation Roll on Monday. It's going to be an exciting day for all to enjoy.
And that astronaut can be seen playing a bit with the floating egg. Well, he's floating too. You can find it at NASA's Twitter. Associated Press writes, the American Egg Board is continuing its longtime sponsorship this year and donating about 30,000 eggs that were hand-dyed by a North Carolina farm, according to Emily Metz, board president and CEO. And inflation, an outbreak of the bird flu, and increased demand for eggs during the holiday baking season combined to send egg prices skyrocketing last year. Emily Metz said the donation of 30,000 eggs is a fraction of the 100 billion eggs that are produced and consumed yearly in the United States. She also said the Egg Board is donating more than 5 million eggs to food banks nationwide in the weeks leading up to Passover and Easter to help with holiday meals. And this year, for the first time, the hard-boiled eggs used in the traditional egg roll and egg hunt on Monday will be composted and used to fertilize gardens and parklands throughout District of Columbia, Maryland, and Virginia. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Sign up for C-SPAN's evening newsletter, word for word, to get the stories Washington is talking about sent to your inbox every day. Subscribe at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.